Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Happy tidings to all, and welcome to Episode 1 of the Story of Nowhere podcast, A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 1, Shamans, Seers, and Sacred Geometry. As you could no doubt tell from the title, and if you listened to the last show, you would already know, that this is the first part of a series I'll be doing over the next few episodes. Now before I really get into it, I do want to make sure that everybody listening to this has already heard Episode 0, which serves as a short introduction to this podcast. And hopefully you've also been familiarized with my book, The Story of Nowhere, which is available as a free ebook, a free audiobook, and for purchase as a paperback at storyofnowhere.com. The book is where this whole operation of mine really gets started, so that's where I recommend you get started if this is the first you're hearing of it. Now, if you're wondering why I'm doing a series on critical thinking, or why I'm choosing to start with it, my answer is really quite simple. I think that developing our own critical thinking abilities is the best defense against utopianism and tyranny that we've got. We'll be a lot less likely to fall for the promises of shifty politicians and media jack-offs, and be better equipped to operate outside of the systems they expect us to operate within and be dependent on. So it only seemed appropriate not only to do a series on critical thinking, but to do it first, so that we're all starting with this basic understanding that reason is the key to our a-utopian independence. Now before you say, ugh, boring, a logic series, this isn't going to be some dry discussion about how if A is B and B is C, then A is C, or just me rattling off logical fallacies. Now, of course, there will be some of that, it's definitely going to come up. It just kind of goes with the logic territory. But generally speaking, this series is instead going to focus on the story of critical thought, how it's figured into history, how it's changed, how it's stayed the same, and how it's been abused. If you like history and philosophy like I do, and are interested in hearing about these things from an angle you probably haven't before, then you should dig this series. Now, admittedly, this first episode will be pretty broad, because I've got to lay the groundwork for what critical thought is, and also talk about the time before honest-to-God critical thinking, as we imagine it, really got started in ancient Greece with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. We'll get to them in episode 2. But for now, do whatever it is you do while you listen to podcasts, and enjoy A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 1, Shamans, Seers, and Sacred Geometry. As I said, this is going to be a brief historical overview of critical thinking, and as such, I think it'd be appropriate to define our terms first. I'm not going to get too stingy or rigid about this, though. Much like utopia, as we saw in the last episode, critical thinking is pretty difficult to define. Remember that old quote about pornography from back in probably the 80s or 90s? I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. Well, critical thinking is kind of like that. I can't define it, but I know when it's not being used. Regardless, I'm still going to do my best to try to express at least a good sketch of what critical thinking is, even though most of you listening probably already have an intuitive idea as to what it is. Still, I think it's best to try and articulate it, to put it into words. According to my Reader's Digest Great Encyclopedic Dictionary, critical is defined as 1. Given to fault-finding or severe judgments, and 2. Exhibiting careful, precise judgments and evaluations. Thought is defined as the act or process of using the mind actively and deliberately. Note that the first entry for the word critical says given to fault-finding. That's really important, because one thing that we can say about critical thinking is that it's not about being nice or passive. It's an aggressive activity in a way, meant to identify and address problems in thought. However, as we'll see once we really get going with the history, this isn't mindless or spiteful fault-finding. Critical thinking isn't about finding every last fault and making a big deal about insignificant details. It's about finding relevant faults and addressing important details. Entry number 4 for critical in my dictionary is of the nature of a crisis or turning point, crucial, decisive. So in simpler terms, it means important. Addressing crucial flaws in somebody's arguments is to be critical of their arguments, to correct them for using your instead of youre is not critical. The second entry for critical that I read before mentions precision and judgment. To be critical is to weigh and to measure. It's no coincidence that critical thought is generally used interchangeably with rationality. Rationally, of course, coming from ratio, the Latin word for numbering and calculating. Criticism is all about making value judgments. In the case of thought, it's about valuing the activity of the human mind. Now, actually, that's not a bad definition for critical thinking, if I may say so myself. But we could get a little more specific than that. If you go to criticalthinking.org, you'll find the homepage for the Foundation for Critical Thinking. And they've got an article all about defining critical thinking, and it's very cleverly titled, Defining Critical Thinking. This is a good article because it puts together what a few different people have said on the subject over the years and creates a kind of composite definition. According to the article, quote, critical thinking is that mode of thinking about any subject, content, or problem in which the thinker improves the quality of his or her thinking by skillfully taking charge of the structures inherent in thinking and imposing intellectual standards on them, unquote. In other words, reason is inherent to all humans. Critical thinking merely articulates this inherent process in order to make it more accessible, and therefore more useful. This gets a little more specific than my definition from before. Basically, critical thinking is all about recognizing errors, biases, and inconsistencies in thought and trying to correct these. The ultimate aim of critical thought, therefore, is to improve one's thinking and to make it more closely reflect the external, not internal, world. Some might say that critical thinking is about searching for objective truth. For this reason, critical thinking often involves a methodology, as we'll see later on. In the criticalthinking.org definition, they use the phrase intellectual standards. Whether it's a standard, a method, a formula, whatever, call it what you like, critical thinking is supposed to be the same across the board. In other words, it'd be very difficult to have a meaningful discussion or debate with someone if you aren't already in agreement about what constitutes a valid point. Likewise, you can't have a good debate with someone who has a totally different understanding of what constitutes a logical fallacy. Critical thinking, then, is the frame within which productive discourse occurs. The more defined this frame is, the more useful it is. So this is what we'll be doing in this series, tracking the slow formation of a universal standard for evaluating thought, and following the ever-clarifying definition of the innate human impetus to reason. But here at the outset, we've only got some vague, slightly articulated ideas of what critical thinking is. Critical thinking is what you're doing if you're thinking about thinking. It's the essence of rationality. It's the ability to weigh ideas against each other and to come to sensible conclusions. It is the process of revealing what is possible by eliminating what is impossible. It's the ability to reflect on reflections, to identify patterns, to create art, and to evolve ideas. It is the seed of civilization. Now, I could spend this whole show, this whole series, really, just comparing the various definitions of critical thinking. But I think we'd still wind up with a bunch of vague, wishy-washy sort of isms. I think it'd be much better to defer to history, to start at the beginning and see what people have said about thinking, and how they've used their thinking, and how they've expanded on the thinking of those who came before. Maybe, by the end of this series, we'll have some kind of a substantial understanding as to what critical thought actually is. In planning for this series, I quickly found that, although I can be thorough, I can't be exhaustive. If I covered every relevant milestone or leap in critical thought through history, this series would be 80, 90, 100 episodes long. So I'm just going to hit what really stood out to me as the most relevant and interesting moments. With that said, let's get to it. I said a minute ago that we should start at the beginning, but it's not exactly clear where or when the beginning is or was. For generations, the Greek city-state of Athens was hailed as the birthplace of rationality. In that ancient polis, we find stellar architecture, immaculate statuary, early democracy, the beginnings of atomic theory, and of course, philosophy. Of all the city's philosophers, Socrates may well have been the archetype of them all. He lived and died for rational thought. His incessant questioning inspired the curious among him to see life in a new light. He got them to think about their thinking. For this, history has remembered him as the foremost martyr for philosophy and the father of reason. And yet, great as he was, it would be absolutely ridiculous to begin our story of critical thinking with Socrates. And I think even he himself would agree. Even if we imagine that he was the very first human being to think about thinking, and therefore the inventor of critical thought, which seems rather absurd, we cannot imagine that his philosophy simply sprang out of his head fully formed and ready to go, like Athena from the head of Zeus. No, Socrates' critical method was built upon eons of human thought and development that long preceded him. These roots of critical thought are the focus of this episode. Socrates was executed in 399 BC. Let's call it 400 BC. Standard history tells us that civilization began in the region of Sumer, located in Mesopotamia, around 4000 BC. Now there are some who claim that civilization is even older than that, but for now let's just stick with Sumer as the oldest of OGs. That means that civilization began 3,600 years before Socrates took the big gulp. In other words, Sumer was over 1,000 years more ancient to Socrates than Socrates is to us. Just sit with that for a minute. That's like all of history, from Alexander the Great to the modern day, plus a whole extra Middle Ages, all between Sumer and Socrates. That's a fucking lot of time. And by the way, I'm being conservative with my numbers there, very conservative. We could easily squeeze another half of Middle Ages in there if we really wanted to. Easily. So now consider that the Elamites, the neighbors of the Sumerians, are generally thought to have invented the wheel. The Sumerians themselves lived in buildings carved from stone. They had functioning economies. They had detailed religion. They grasped mathematics, at least enough to build buildings and collect taxes. Oh, and they had the earliest known written language. We can't seriously be expected to look at all the advancements the Sumerians were responsible for, and then say there was no critical thinking for another 3,000 years, give or take a few centuries. That just seems preposterous. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that all Sumerians were critical thinkers, but some most certainly were, at least often enough to make major advances in the history of civilization. So here's a good opportunity for a modern-day takeaway. Critical thinking is a verb, like running. So you can critically think, or you cannot. You can run, or you cannot. But aside from some serious impairment, anyone can do either, and nobody does either all of the time. So we can have people who run a lot, who call themselves runners, who actually are probably not running most of the time. On the flip side, there are people like me who would never in a million years identify as runners, yet who have most certainly ran a great deal in their lives. Likewise, we can have people who think critically when it comes to their job, but then don't apply their critical thinking when they're, oh, I don't know, watching the news. So it's like running. Nobody does it all the time, most people do it some of the time, and a few people do it none of the time. So just because some bastard in Sumer was smart enough to figure out writing, doesn't mean that every tax collector who wrote was some brilliant critical thinker. Same goes for the wheel. And same goes for us today. Just because somebody invented the radio and the shoehorn and the light bulb and silly putty and computers doesn't mean that we are all genius inventors. Right. That said, even Sumer is a bad starting point for this little excursion of ours. I mean, shit, if you thought Sumer was old at 6,000 years, wait till you hear that the human race is something like 200,000 years old. These days, some scientists are even trying to push it back to 300,000, but damn, you know, 200,000 is good enough for us today. And we're just talking Homo sapiens, basically the same creatures that we are today, first popping up 194,000 years before settling down in Sumer. If we took that 200,000-year age of our species and condensed it down into the lifespan of a lady who died at 100, Sumer would have gotten started when she was 97. In other words, the vast majority of human history is actually prehistory, or pre-civilization. And it's in this time that we find the true beginnings of human reason. The great megalithic site of Göbekli Tepe, located in Turkey, is thought to be about 12,000 years old, as ancient to Sumer as Sumer is to us. The Lascaux Caves in France contain paintings of animals, some of which are now extinct, figured to be about 17,000 years old. Careful and arguably even religious burial of the dead appears at least 20,000 years ago. Deliberately crafted stone tools predate even the earliest beginnings of modern man by millions of years. People have been thinking for a long time. Now, I'm not claiming that the kind of thinking that was going on, say, 20,000 years ago, was the critical thinking of Socrates or even some of the Sumerians. It was probably a more immediate, practical, problem-solving kind of thinking, geared more toward survival than toward philosophy or long-term technical development. But what we can say for sure is that those ancestors of ours who painted caves, buried their dead, and spoke languages were engaging in abstract thought, if not critical thought. It's this sort of pre-critical thought that we must really begin with, for without it there could be no thinking about thinking. First, humans had to think about food, shelter, and their surroundings. It's unfortunate that pre-critical peoples didn't deliberately leave us records of their activities, though I suppose if they had, they wouldn't really be pre-critical. These people were, no doubt, concerned with the future, although the future that worried them was surely a very immediate one. How do we kill all the snakes before they eat the babies surely takes priority over leaving my dumbass a big stone book. I'll stick to the Flintstones and count my blessings. So while we can't know all that much about what life was like 20 or 30 or 40,000 years ago, we can look to tribal cultures and see how human societies function outside of the civilized world. However, this won't reveal what it was like with any certainty way back when. H.G. Wells, who I generally think was a pretty sketchy dude, makes the sensible point in The Outline of History that, quote, "In these questions of primitive thought and religion, we must remember that the lowly and savage peoples of today probably throw very little light on the mental state of men before the days of fully developed language. Primordial man could have had little or no tradition before the development of speech. All savage and primitive peoples of today, on the contrary, are soaked in tradition, the tradition of thousands of generations. They may have weapons like their remote ancestors and methods like them, but what were slight and shallow impressions on the minds of their predecessors are now deep and intricate grooves worn throughout the intervening centuries, generation by generation." Unquote. I think that he's right to bring up the importance of language in the development of human thought, and to suggest that tribal cultures, which tend to be highly traditional, can't really shed much light on the primitive humans that lived before the time of the spoken word. I'll say a bit more on language in a minute. But still, I don't think it's hopeless. Certainly, tribal life is more similar to prehistoric life than the average American's life is, and that ought to count for something. Even if the remote tribes of South America, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Islands can't tell us anything about life 200,000 years ago in the Paleolithic, they do provide a window to what life may have been like in the Neolithic, around 10,000 years ago, in the millennia leading up to the first civilizations. The kind of thinking that concerns tribal cultures is that which has to do with living effectively in a hostile environment. Such was the case with our earliest ancestors, only more so, for they lacked that level of security provided by generations of established tradition, as H.G. Wells points out. Still, our forebears seem to have learned pretty early on that, like Johnny Cash said, the world is rough, and if a man's gonna make it, he's gotta be tough. But the human body on its own is anything but tough when compared to what it's up against. So humans who've had to live in the wilds have taken their cues from the creatures that dwell among them. The first tools were imitations of those implements that animals possess and we lack. After living in fear of claws and fangs for innumerable eons, humans finally realized they could make their own in the form of knives, shovels, and spears. For want of fur, our ancestors stripped it from their warmer rivals and dressed in skins and hides. To protect their soft feet, our ancient parents made shoes to mimic the footpads and hooves of wolves, bears, and deer. And with fire, which legend tells us was the first of all humanity's discoveries, the environment itself was made to serve. And merely creating tools isn't all. The tribal man or woman has then to use those tools cleverly and effectively. In the first volume of his Story of Civilization, Will Durant writes,
"With what skill those ancestors ferreted out from land and sea the food that was the basis of our simple societies. They grubbed edible things from the earth with bare hands, they imitated or used the claws and tusks of the animals, and fashioned tools out of ivory, bone, or stone. They made nets and traps and snares of rushes or fiber, and devised innumerable artifices for fishing and hunting their prey. The Polynesians had nets 1,000 ells long, which could be handled only by 100 men. In such ways, economic provision grew hand in hand with political organization, and the united quest for food helped to generate the state. The Tlingit fisherman put upon his head a cap like the head of a seal, and hiding his body among the rocks made a noise like a seal. Seals came toward him, and he speared them with the clear conscience of primitive war. Many tribes threw narcotics into the streams to stupefy the fish into cooperation with the fishermen. The Tahitians, for example, put into the water an intoxicating mixture prepared from the huteo nut or the hora plant. The fish, drunk with it, floated leisurely on the surface and were caught at the angler's will. Australian natives, swimming underwater while breathing through a reed, pulled ducks beneath the surface by the legs and gently held them there till they were pacified. The Tarahumaras caught birds by stringing kernels on tough fibers half buried under the ground. The birds ate the kernels, and the Tarahumaras ate the birds."
Man is the animal that crafts himself out of the world. Nobody appreciates this more than those whose lives are most in tune with the roots of human experience. To be able to do so is to think abstractly, in concepts and not merely with particulars, which, so far as we know, is very uniquely human. Quoting Peter Kreeft in Socratic Logic, quote, "When we form a concept, we abstract one aspect of a concrete thing from all of its other aspects. For example, the size of a flower when we measure it, or its color when we paint it. No one can physically or chemically separate the size from the color, or either one from the whole flower, but anyone can do it mentally. When we abstract or mentally separate adjectives from nouns, we can abstract or mentally separate adjectives from nouns. Animals simply perceive green grass, but even the most primitive men mentally distinguish the green from the grass, and this enabled them to imagine green skin or red grass, even though they had never seen it. And once they imagined these things, they set about making them, for example by dyeing their skin green from the juice of grasses, or painting pictures of red grass with dye made from beet juice. Technology and art both flow from this human power of abstraction." Unquote. So, whether we're talking about prehistoric societies or modern tribal societies, one thing to bear in mind is that these people are no dummies. Just because they don't have satellite TV doesn't mean they aren't rational people. In fact, if we're talking about raw problem-solving abilities, people who can survive and thrive outside of the safe walls of civilization are the absolute masters. If shit hit the fan, like really, really hit the fan, these are the people who will actually have a chance. Them and all the lucky bastards who happen to be at Costco at the time. Assuming they're alone in the store, of course. Everyone else will be pretty much screwed. So the nature people are definitely getting some points for practicality. While certain pockets of prehistoric humanity obviously made the transition to quote-unquote civilization, those that remained tribal seem to have decided that they'd figured out exactly how much they need to know, and any advancement beyond that point would be a waste of energy. Again, Will Durant writes,
"The moment man begins to take thought of the morrow, he passes out of the Garden of Eden into the veil of anxiety. The pale cast of worry settles down upon him, greed is sharpened, property begins, and the good cheer of the thoughtless native disappears. The American Negro is making this transition today. 'Of what are you thinking?' Peary asked one of his Eskimo guides. 'I do not have to think,' was the answer. 'I have plenty of meat.' 'Not to think unless we have to. There is much to be said for this as the summation of wisdom.' Nevertheless, there were difficulties in this carelessness, and those organisms that outgrew it came to possess a serious advantage in the struggle for survival. The dog that buried the bone which even a canine appetite could not manage, the squirrel that gathered nuts for a later feast, the bees that filled the comb with honey, the ants that laid up stores for a rainy day, these were among the first creators of civilization. It was they, or other subtle creatures like them, who taught our ancestors the art of providing for tomorrow out of the surplus of today, or of preparing for winter in summer's time of plenty."
Indeed. But while they certainly seem to specialize primarily in survival skills and subsequently shrug off any unnecessary or superficial thought, there is an undeniably strong spiritual element among pre-civilized folks. I think that here, in the religiosity of the tribe, we find yet another critical piece of what would become critical thinking. Tribal societies that exist today generally have animistic religions. Incidentally, animism seems to be one of the very oldest religious systems known to man, maybe even the oldest. Simply, it's the belief that the world is filled to the brim with spirits. They're everywhere, in everything, and behind every action. Spirits animate the world, hence animism. To our modern sensibilities, this might seem like the opposite of critical thinking, but again, I think that, on the contrary, this is just its beginning. An animist looks beyond the particulars of the material world and sees something transcendent. So, while to an animal, a river is just a rush of water, to an animist, the river is a complicated bundle of intelligence. It quenches the thirst of the animals and the people. It waters the land, it houses the fish, and it rises and dries as if it has a will of its own. And yet, the animist knows that the river responds to him. He knows that if he puts shit or garbage in the river, the water will no longer be healthy, and thus he will be punished. On the other hand, if he respects the river, the spirits will be kind to him. Animism acknowledges that there is a world outside of the individual's subjective experience. It signifies a broadening of the human mind as it began to ponder the complexities and patterns of the world outside of itself. The animist is empathetic and responsible and sees the world as a gigantic mind. This worldview reveals the animist's own intelligence and set our species on the course of asking all of the big, critical questions. Who are we? Where are we? What is life? What is reality? Unfortunately, we can't know just how old animism is, though it is doubtlessly many, many millennia older than civilization itself. It may be the case that, without the lessons of animism planted so deeply in our minds, civilization would have never even been possible. The shaman is the intercessor between the material world and the spiritual world. But his ain't the airy-fairy, stay positive, I'm a vegan spiritualism we have now. The shaman life is bitter work. He must endure grueling physical and mental ordeals to heighten his conscious state and establish a connection with the divine intelligences that govern the world. Some shamans will pierce and tattoo themselves, others will starve themselves, and others still will consume incredible amounts of psychedelic drugs, all to push the limits of human experience. It's strange to say, but in a weird sort of way, the shaman is kind of the first critical thinker. His intention is to improve his mental, or as he might say, spiritual capacity, in order to more closely reflect the external, objective, true world. Now, of course, the shaman isn't using a rational methodology. And we might see some of his practices as, well, let's say, antiquated. But there's no denying that he's willing to go to great pains in pursuit of truth. In that, at least, he has the seeking spirit of a critical thinker. One more thing about pre-civilized peoples before moving on. I said before that I wanted to remark on language. Namely, I think that, perhaps short only of the dawn of human consciousness itself, whatever the hell that was, the development of language was the first revolution in the long chain of revolutions that led to critical thinking. Without the spoken word, and much later the written word, the sort of abstract cogitation that thinking about thinking requires would simply not be possible. At least, it wouldn't be possible in any way that's recognizable to us, presumably. Even the actual operation of language itself is a very rudimentary form of critical thought. By associating thoughts to words, by choosing this word over that word, by receiving the words of others and then breaking them down into thoughts and ideas, by engaging with language at all, one evaluates and thinks about thoughts and sharpens his or her cognitive ability. Now, Lord knows there's plenty more to say about language, and it's a subject that I'm pretty interested in. But I'm going to leave it at that for now because we've got to move on. But I'm pretty sure I'll do an episode in the future just about human language and all the neat stuff that goes along with it. So, while tribal cultures, present and long past, offer us no clear method of critical thinking, they do provide all humanity with an intuitive and highly effective bedrock of rationality. Now that we've taken a quick look at that bedrock, we can turn our attention to ancient civilizations, the first civilizations, and see how critical thinking would continue to develop. Before we do that, though, I want to make a quick, slightly tangential note on the dawn of civilization. For a very long time, it was more or less taken for granted that the earliest governments which popped up in Mesopotamia 6,000 years ago arose as the natural and inevitable result of agriculture. The domestication of plants and animals allowed humanity to settle into stationary and secure cities, where food was abundant. Within these cities, the recognizable hierarchies of government naturally arose in order to distribute this food and to protect the productive classes. As I say, this has been the standard narrative for generations. Will Durant, in his story of civilization, which I pulled from earlier, I think, went a long way in popularizing this belief among the general population. Durant's been a pretty big influence on me, and we'll be hearing more of him in this series and in future episodes. In fact, the title of my book and this whole project is a nod to Durant. He wrote The Story of Philosophy and The Story of Civilization, and of course my project is The Story of Nowhere. But Will did not write a Bible. The first volume of The Story of Civilization came out in 1935, and obviously, much of our understanding of the very ancient world has been updated since then. One of these things that's being updated at this very moment is the idea that states arose organically and almost immediately out of early agricultural societies. In his 2017 book Against the Grain, James C. Scott sums up this typical narrative as follows. Quote, "Historical humankind has been mesmerized by the narrative of progress and civilization as codified by the first great agrarian kingdoms. As new and powerful societies, they were determined to distinguish themselves as sharply as possible from the populations from which they sprang and that still beckoned and threatened at their fringes. In its essentials, it was an ascent of man story. Agriculture, it held, replaced the savage, wild, primitive, lawless, and violent world of hunter-gatherers and nomads. Fixed field crops, on the other hand, were the origin and guarantor of the settled life, of formal religion, of society, and of government by laws. Those who refused to take up agriculture did so out of ignorance or a refusal to adapt. In virtually all early agricultural settings, the superiority of farming was underwritten by an elaborate mythology recounting how a powerful god or goddess entrusted the sacred grain to a chosen people." Unquote. In his book, Scott challenges this narrative, and in effect rewrites the history of both domestication and the state based upon mountains of new evidence. He shows that agriculture and statehood developed in relative isolation to one another, and most importantly, that early states were not the centers of progress, luxury, and health they were once thought to be. Instead, the first states were riddled with hunger and disease, and rather than being composed of willing citizens naturally attracted to the city because it complemented the sedentary life of the agriculturalist, states largely had to force people to join them. Slavery, not agriculture, is the foundation of the state. An identifying characteristic of early states is that they had walls, and as Scott points out, while these were no doubt built to keep marauders out, they were equally intended to keep taxpayers in. He even demonstrates how the life of the average hunter-gatherer, long thought to have been inferior to the civilized life, was in many ways healthier, happier, and freer, arguably superior in all the ways that really matter. So why do I bring this up? Well, for a few reasons. One, it's really interesting. Two, anyone fascinated by ancient history, the origins of government, and the transformation of humanity from quote-unquote savage to quote-unquote citizen should absolutely read James C. Scott's Against the Grain. Three, there's a useful critical thinking lesson in this tangent. Oftentimes, narratives that have been accepted seemingly forever change overnight in light of new evidence. Critical thinking holds no tradition as sacred, and what was considered to be unquestionably true yesterday might be seen as absurdly false tomorrow. To be a critical thinker, you must be prepared to smash some of your golden calves. Fourth, I let myself have this tangent here because I wanted to clarify that I'm not assuming the old, tidy, impulsively pro-government explanation for the origins of the states I'm about to cover. Still, though, there is an obvious disparity between pre-civilized and civilized societies when it comes to evidence of critical thinking as we're concerned with it here. Of course, this could just be due to a lack of surviving records. As Scott points out in Against the Grain, quote, "If you built monumentally in stone and left your debris conveniently in a single place, you were likely to be discovered and to dominate the pages of ancient history. If, on the other hand, you built with wood, bamboo, or reeds, you were much less likely to appear in the archaeological record. And if you were hunter-gatherers or nomads, however numerous, spreading your biodegradable trash thinly across the landscape, you were likely to vanish entirely from the archaeological record." Unquote. Thus, I am forced to turn my attention, really for the rest of this series, to those well-preserved civilizations, the great states of history, if I want to track the continuing development of human cogitation. I deny our pre-civilized ancestors nothing, but I can only work with what I've got. So, without further ado, let's get back to it. Critical thinking in the early states. We'll start in the east and work our way west. The first Chinese state enters the archaeological record around 1600 BC. So while it's not the most ancient civilization, and though it's gone through a plethora of wars, revolutions, cultural upheavals, and more wars, it is by far the world's oldest surviving civilization. This first state, called Shang or Yin, which developed around the southern basin of the Yellow River, where varying degrees of agriculture had already been going on for over 6,000 years, is said to have risen out of the ashes of an even older dynasty, known as Jia. However, because the dynasty isn't mentioned in Chinese records until some 400 years after its supposed collapse, the actual historicity of Jia is uncertain. It's steeped in myth, said to have been founded in the 21st century BC by Yu the Great, the hero of the Chinese Great Flood tale. It's interesting to note that this story is itself an ode to critical thought. To combat the cataclysmic flooding of the Yellow River, Yu designed an irrigation system to redirect the oncoming waters. But averting catastrophe wasn't all he accomplished. By channeling the floodwaters to farmlands, he brought about an age of abundance. China's first hero and first dynastic king was an engineering genius. However, ancient China's biggest and probably more real contributions to the story of critical thinking come not from the Jia dynasty, nor the following Shang dynasty, but from the Zhou dynasty, which followed that, starting in the mid-11th century BC, and not completely falling until the 3rd century BC. The major leaps in critical thought that we're concerned with here occurred within a relatively small window of time in the 800-year history of the Zhou dynasty, a period of just about 100 years near the latter half of the dynasty's reign. It was amid the chaos of this period that new and influential schools of thought took shape, schools of thought which are still with us even today, some 2,500 years later. In this episode, we will look at just one of these schools. Kung Futsu, or Master Kung, known in the West as Confucius, lived from 551 to 479 BC. Just to give you a frame of reference, Confucius died less than 10 years before the birth of Socrates, though obviously nobody in ancient Greece had ever heard of Confucius, and even in China his school of thought didn't really pick up any traction until years after his death. Now, unlike Western philosophy, which is focused so much on the external, operational truths of the natural world, Chinese philosophy always placed an emphasis on improving human beings. That's not to say that Western philosophers weren't concerned with this. Obviously, we can point to some great ethical philosophers, like Socrates, who had similar motives to Confucius. Still, though, while the West oscillated between concern with man and concern with nature, the Chinese tended to err on the side of man. This was typified by Confucius, whose corpus of work was dedicated to turning men and women into good citizens. Obviously, this kind of thinking has political implications, and Confucius was a political philosopher, to be sure. The political implications of his philosophy are of particular relevance to this show's guiding topic of utopianism. However, for the sake of this series, I'll leave that aside for now, promise an episode on that aspect of Confucianism at a later date, and focus strictly on what the philosophy has to say about critical thinking. The Confucian virtue of Zhi is usually translated as either moral goodness or wisdom. If it seems strange that these two seemingly independent ideas are both used to describe Zhi, this is because Confucian philosophy doesn't consider knowledge or logic a distinct branch of philosophy from ethics or morality, as Western philosophers tend to do. In Confucianism, laws of logic are laws of morality. Now, regarding the translation of the term Zhi, I read an interesting article from unpolishedjade.wordpress.com called Zhi in Confucian Literature that breaks down the actual Chinese character of Zhi to get a better idea of the term's meaning. Now, I don't speak or read Chinese at all, so I just have to take the author's word for all this. And because I can't really follow up on this information myself, I'm not going to spend too much time on this article or lean very heavily on it. But nonetheless, it adds something neat to our conversation, so I do want to address it quickly. Apparently, according to this article, there are actually two Zhis in Confucianism. One simply meaning to know, or to understand, and the other, more complicated one, meaning wisdom, which we're dealing with here. Now this second one is commonly said to be composed of two Chinese characters, the character for the first Zhi plus the character Rei, meaning sun. Now apparently, this indicates some kind of heavenly or divine knowledge. It's not characterized this way in the article, but the first thing I thought of was enlightenment. Anyway, the author of this article actually contends that etymology, saying instead that the Zhi in question is a combination of the character to know plus the character yue, meaning to speak. So we can put them together and see that, according to our author, the literal translation of the virtue Zhi is to speak knowledge, or to speak understanding. I find this fascinating, because we're going to see a very similar breakdown later on in the third episode of this series, when we look at the idea of rhetoric, as put forward in the medieval Trivium. Now that's not to say that the Zhi conception of wisdom is identical to the European conception. The Unpolished Jade article actually goes on to talk about how Zhi is different from the Western idea of wisdom, as in the West, we see wisdom as a passive state of mind, whereas in Confucianism, Zhi is the active application of one's knowledge. This is interesting because, regardless of whatever implications of passivity wisdom might have in the common Western mind, the classical or philosophical understanding of rhetoric in the West very much matches the conception of Xi, although the author of the Unpolished Jade article doesn't really bring this up. In the Middle Ages, moral or scientific knowledge only mattered if it was put out into the world. In other words, it had to be spoken. The same would appear to be the case over 1,000 years earlier in China. Richard Grove, from TragedyandHope.com, I think, sums up this idea very nicely when he says wisdom is knowledge shared. But, like I said, I don't speak or read Chinese, so I won't say anything more on the etymology of Xi. Let's talk about the virtue itself. The path to Xi is education, which Confucius talks about at length in his Record on the Subject of Education. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find a translation of this particular document for free online. I'm getting it from 3,000 Years of Educational Wisdom, a collection of documents edited by Robert Ulich. It's a great resource, and I'll be pulling from it later on as well. I've placed a link to purchase the book in the show notes of this episode if you're interested. Anyway, the path to Xi is education. In this document, Confucius describes an ideal schooling system that would foster moral righteousness in all the population. It's a very strict system, adhering to a set order in which subjects are taught, assigning large amounts of homework, and demanding absolute and total obedience and silence from the students. The purpose of this, he says, is to discipline the minds of the students, and thus discipline the whole society. Only through this discipline can the people expect to live happy, fulfilled, truly human lives. In defense of this position, he attempts to present logical arguments, evidence to support his claim. This is one of the requirements for critical thinking. First, he says, quote, "If a student do not learn at college to play in tune, he cannot quietly enjoy his lutes. If he do not learn extensively the figures of poetry, he cannot quietly enjoy the odes. If he do not learn the varieties of dress, he cannot quietly take part in the different ceremonies. If he do not acquire the various accomplishments, he cannot take delight in learning. Therefore, a student of talents and virtue pursues his studies." Unquote. In other words, one cannot truly enjoy the products of disciplined minds, like music, poetry, and ceremonies, without truly disciplining his or her own mind and coming to understand the things that lie beneath those products, musical notes, poetic verse, and ceremonial dress. For this reason, the virtuous student eagerly goes to school. He presents another argument in favor of public schools. Quote, "Prohibition of evil after it has manifested meets with opposition and is not successful." Unquote. Instead, the good school, by instilling virtue in children at an early age, would prevent evil from arising, which would be far better than trying to cure evil after the fact. So here we have Confucius providing arguments for his claim. And this is evidence that Confucius valued critical thought, and that he used it to some degree. Now, I don't particularly agree with his arguments. I mean, I can accept the idea that knowledge of a subject makes it more enjoyable, and I can also appreciate that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But where I depart from Confucius is where he asserts that these premises justify a state school system that instructs students in a standardized, homogeneous fashion. If you read my book, you know that I consider such endeavors to be harmful and utopian. And there's a lot of this in Confucius's writing, actually. I'll agree and agree and agree, until suddenly he makes some gigantic utopian leap that I just can't follow. But again, I bring up his arguments for school because they are arguments, not because they're right or good arguments. Confucius recognizes that when making a claim, one must provide reasons for it. Without this understanding, there is no critical thinking. So while Xi is cultivated in the schools, according to Confucius, it begins with the innate sense of right and wrong within every person. This innate sense, added to by a love of learning, would lead to a rational reflection on ideas, and ultimately result in one engaging in rational and virtuous action. Remember how I said there's no distinction between logic and ethics in Confucianism? Well, here we are. Confucius himself described this reflection as the noblest method of learning wisdom. Obviously, Critical thinking was of the highest importance to the great sage. Mencius, another so-called great sage, considered second only to Confucius himself, also provided an argument for one of his major claims. Well, sort of. He believed that humanity is innately good. To support this, he argued that, quote, all human beings are alike by nature. The sage who is good by nature is a person. Therefore, all human beings are good by nature, unquote. All right, so maybe that's not a great argument. For one thing, it violates a very fundamental rule of the logical syllogism, which states that if there is a particular premise, in this example, the sage being one person, then the conclusion must also be particular, and of course in this case it is universal, because he makes a claim about all human beings based on a particular example. But that's a little bit more technical than we're going to get in this series. Suffice it to say that this does not meet the standard of a good argument, because even if we accept its premises that all human beings are alike by nature, and the sage who is good by nature is a person, the conclusion that all human beings are good by nature does not necessarily follow from these premises. Just because all humans are alike doesn't mean they're all alike in every way, and the sage's goodness could very well be one of the ways in which not all people are alike. Maybe an example of the exact same structure of an argument or non-argument with different terms will elucidate why this is faulty logic. All dogs are alike by nature. The greyhound, which is large by nature, is a dog. Therefore, all dogs are large by nature. So there. We could go on and on about critical thinking in Confucianism, but I've got to end it somewhere if I want to cover everything I wanted to get to in this episode, and now seems as good a time as any. I had hoped to get a bit into the Tao Te Ching and the Art of War, but it looks like we're going to have to save those juicy masterpieces for a later episode, because now it's time to zip on over to, that's right, Mesopotamia. Fertile Crescent, the land between two rivers, the first, the oldest, the oldest of OGs. Though there had already been sedentary and semi-agricultural societies in the area for thousands of years, the civilized history of this land begins with Sumer, around 4000 BC, and ends when the great state of Babylon fell to the Persians in 539 BC. Perhaps the Sumerians' biggest contribution to both the history of critical thinking and to civilization itself was the invention of writing. This seems to have happened a very long time ago. According to Charles Van Doren, in his book A History of Knowledge, quote, a kind of primitive script was developed in this extremely fertile region as early as about 8000 BC. By 3500 BC, this system of writing had become coherent. By 3100 BC, it is unambiguously related to the Sumerian language. Unquote. The existence of written language shows a relatively high degree of abstract or even critical ability, as I said at the beginning of the show, as it demands that the literate person engage very deeply with concepts. Of course, the vast majority of Sumerians weren't literate, and most who were probably only used that literacy for accounting purposes. Still, it's an impressive feat. Boring clerical work wasn't all the Sumerians used their writing for, however. They also used it to pass down myths, such as the story of Oannes and the Seven Abgal. For the Sumerians, this was the origin story of critical thinking. The Abgal were the seven great sages, the fishmen who rose from the waters and brought mankind gifts of knowledge and wisdom. The first among them was Oannes, perhaps the son of the water god Enki. Unfortunately, not much is known about the specifics of the Abgal and their gifts of knowledge, though in the Bit Meseri, a ritual incantation text perhaps as old as the 10th century BC, they are described as, quote, the pure Puradu fishes, the Puradu fishes of the sea, seven of them, the seven sages, who have originated in the river, who control the plans of heaven and earth, unquote. According to Will Durant,
Berosus, a Babylonian historian writing about 250 BC, knew of Sumeria only through the veil of a legend. He described a race of monsters led by one Oannes, coming out of the Persian Gulf and introducing the arts of agriculture, metalworking, and writing. All the things that make for the amelioration of life, he declares, were bequeathed to men by Oannes, and since that time no further inventions have been made. Not till 2,000 years after Berosus was Sumeria rediscovered.
Berosus tells us that it was Oannes who told humanity of the creation of the world. The Babylonian version of this Mesopotamian creation myth is available to us today, and is known as the Enuma Elish, meaning "when on high," named for the tale's opening lines. The story reveals the Mesopotamian reverence for reason and judgment, as it places Marduk, who unifies all wisdom and holds a comprehensive insight, on the throne of heaven. Like China's Yu, Marduk banished the flood and frost. Like the Greek Zeus, he was the king of the gods, whose planet was Jupiter. Like the god of the Bible, he overcame the great serpent and crafted humankind out of clay. Veiled in the poetic language and explosive hyperbole of religion, the story of Marduk is in fact an ode to the virtue of critical thought. Jordan Peterson explains.
So, we go back to the birthplace of civilization, and we're going to tell the variant of this story that was discovered in the late 1800s. It's a story about this god called Tiamat, or Marduk. So here's the basic structure of the story. You got two primordial gods, Apsu and Tiamat, and they produce offspring, and lots of them. So that's the initial world of the gods. All these gods and goddesses get created by Tiamat and Apsu, right? So then they're running around causing trouble, the first gods. They make a lot of racket. They're doing a lot of impulsive and crazy things, and they make a lot of noise, and they're not very cautious, and they make a big mistake. They kill Apsu, and then they live on his body. So Apsu is also order. And so what happens when you kill order, when you destroy order? What happens? Up comes chaos. That's what happened in Iraq, for example. Okay, so Tiamat comes up and she thinks, I don't know about these things I created. It's like they're really noisy and annoying and careless. And they went and killed Apsu. She's like, he's my consort. He's necessary. It's like, enough of them. They're gone. I'm going to wipe them out. Sort of like God deciding to wipe out everybody with the flood. It's the same idea. These stories all came from the same area, right? So it's another representation of that idea. Okay, so Tiamat's had it. She said, well, these things aren't worth preserving. I'm going to go up and wipe them out, and then everything will be nice and calm and peaceful again. And so the gods, they get wind of this, you know, and they're thinking, hey, this isn't very good, because, like, she's, that's Tiamat we're talking about here. She's Mother Nature, like, in her terrible sense, and she creates everything, and she kills everything, and if she decides that we're, you know, going back to where we came from, that's probably what's going to happen. So they're pretty damn worried about this. And while this is happening, the gods are still marrying each other and producing offspring and so forth. And one day, this new sort of god appears on the scenes, and his name is Marduk. And Marduk is, he's a new thing. They're not really sure what to do with him. And he's got, he can really hear, and he can speak magic words. And so when he says magic words, the day appears and the night disappears. And so he's got the power of speech. That's a big deal. And he's got eyes all the way around his head. He can see everywhere. He can really pay attention. So fine, Marduk goes off and he gets his act together and he gets a big net and he prepares himself and he rides forward and encounters Tiamat. She's this great big dragon-like monster thing. He goes out there and the first thing he does, and this is quite cool, he encapsulates her in a net. Now, so think about that, because she's basically natural chaos. She's the productivity of natural chaos. And so what Marduk does is encapsulates her in a net. That's like a conceptual scheme, right? He puts boundaries around the chaos. And that's what Marduk can do. That's his ability, with his ability to speak and his eyes and his capacity to pay attention. So, whoop, he encloses her, right? And so that's kind of hard on her. She can't get out of the net. And then he cuts her into pieces. And then he makes the world out of the pieces. And in fact, one of Marduk's names is he who fashions ingenious things out of the carcass of Tiamat, which is so cool because it's a tool use metaphor. It's right. How do you conquer nature? Well, you go in there and you you know, decompose it in many ways, and you make weapons out of it, and you make cool things, and that keeps it at bay. And how do you do that? By speaking and paying attention. So that's what the Mesopotamians figured out. Now, they didn't know that that's what they figured out. And the story was, sorry, I know we have to stop. The story was, whatever Marduk represents, that's top god. And so what did he represent? Vision, attention, and speech. And so the Mesopotamians already figured out, everything else should be subordinate to vision, attention, and speech. It's like, good work, Mesopotamians. Sorry, it's my daughter. She wants to pick me up. Hello. Hi there. Where are you? Okay. Bye. Okay. Bye.
Still, of all the Middle Eastern kingdoms that rose and fell in the tumult of the ancient world, the one that most begs for our attention is, of course, Egypt. What can I say about the Egyptians? Not enough, I assure you. Certainly, there's no doubt that these were critical thinkers. Their skill at shaping hard matter to match the images in their heads is practically unparalleled. Frankly, I think it'd be a waste of time for me to talk about what the Egyptians built. I couldn't possibly do them justice. Just do an image search for ancient Egyptian architecture, smoke a joint, kick back, and enjoy the rest of your day. The Egyptians themselves knew of the awe their creations inspired.
Two slender obelisks, monoliths complete in symmetry and grace, rise like pillars of light amid the ruins of statues and temples, and announce in their inscriptions the proud message of Queen Hatshepsut to the world. These obelisks, the carving says, are of hard granite from the quarries of the south. Their tops are of fine gold chosen from the best in all foreign lands. They can be seen from afar on the river. The splendor of their radiance fills the two lands, and when the solar disk appears between them, it is truly as if he rose up into the horizon of the sky. You who after long years shall see these monuments, who shall speak of what I have done, you will say, we do not know, we do not know how they can have made a whole mountain of gold. To gild them I have given gold measured by the bushel, as though it were sacks of grain, for I knew that Karnak is the celestial horizon of the earth. What a queen, and what kings! Perhaps this first great civilization was the finest of all, and we have but begun to uncover its glory?
The material marvels of Egypt are great indeed, though for now I'd like to focus more on its cerebral marvels. The Egyptian Oannes was Thoth, the ibis-headed god of the moon, who invented all things. The ancient priests taught that Thoth had ruled Egypt for 3,000 years, around the 21st millennium BC. Yes, millennium. During his reign, he wrote 20,000 books, and these are the basis for all human wisdom. Whatever the origins of their knowledge, the Egyptians were masters of mathematics and, apparently, of astronomy. Ancient tradition has held that the Egyptians were the inventors of geometry, that is, land measurement, a tradition still encoded in the mystical symbolism of Freemasonry. They had a 365-day calendar, their month was based on the moon, and they apparently invented the clepsydra, the water clock, though they attributed this accomplishment to Thoth. The Egyptians, like the Mesopotamians before them, valued discernment in all things. They worshipped Horus, the champion of the sun, whose famous eye, synonymous with Egyptian myth, demands that its viewer pay attention. In 2880 BC, the old and dying Ptah Hotep, governor of Memphis, left his son a manual for thinking with clarity and judgment. In other words, he left a manual for thinking critically.
The oldest work of philosophy known to us is the Instructions of Ptah Hotep, which apparently goes back to 2880 BC, 2300 years before Confucius, Socrates, and Buddha. Ptah Hotep was governor of Memphis and prime minister to the king under the Fifth Dynasty. Retiring from office, he decided to leave to his son a manual of everlasting wisdom. It was transcribed as an antique classic by some scholars prior to the 18th dynasty. The vizier begins, O prince, my lord, the end of life is at hand. Old age descendeth upon me, feebleness cometh, and childishness is renewed. He that is old lieth down in misery every day. The eyes are small, the ears are deaf. energy is diminished, the heart hath no rest. Command thy servant, therefore, to make over my princely authority to my son. Let me speak unto him the words of them that hearken to the counsel of the men of old time, those that once heard the gods. I pray thee, let this thing be done. His gracious majesty grants the permission, advising him, however, to discourse without causing weariness, advice not yet superfluous for philosophers. Whereupon Ptahotep instructs his son, Be not proud because thou art learned, but discourse with the ignorant man as with the sage. For no limit can be set to skill, neither is there any craftsman that possesseth full advantages. Fair speech is more rare than the emerald that is found by slave maidens among the pebbles. Live, therefore, in the house of kindliness, and men shall come and give gifts of themselves. Beware of making enmity by thy words. Overstep not the truth, neither repeat that which any man, be he prince or peasant, saith in opening the heart. It is abhorrent to the soul. If thou wouldst be a wise man, beget a son for the pleasing of the god. If he make straight his course after thine example, if he arrange thine affairs in due order, do all unto him that is good. If he be heedless and trespass thy rules of conduct and is violent, if every speech that cometh from his mouth is a vile word, then beat thou him, that his talk may be fitting. Precious to a man is the virtue of his son, and good character is a thing remembered. Wheresoever thou goest, beware of consorting with women. If thou wouldst be wise, provide for thine house, and love thy wife that is in thine arms. Silence is more profitable to thee than abundance of speech. Consider how thou mayest be opposed by an expert that speaketh in counsel. It is a foolish thing to speak on every kind of work. If thou be powerful, make thyself to be honored for knowledge and for gentleness. Beware of interruption and of answering words with heat. Put it from thee. Control thyself. And Ptahotep concludes with Horatian pride. Nor shall any word that hath here been set down cease out of this land forever, but shall be made a pattern whereby princes shall speak well. My words shall instruct a man how he shall speak. Yea, he shall become as one skillful in obeying, excellent in speaking. Good fortune shall befall him. He shall be gracious until the end of his life. He shall be contented always.
Perhaps most important of all Egypt's contributions to reason is the influence it had on ancient Greece. One might say that the Egyptian tradition of wisdom, beginning with Thoth 22,000 years ago, if we are to believe their accounts, is still continuing today, as it was passed along to the Greeks, and from them on throughout the history of the West. Solon, the Athenian statesman and father of democracy, traveled to Egypt, where he learned from the priests of Sais. Pythagoras was also said to have studied in Egypt, where he apparently learned all of the mathematical wonders for which he is remembered. Even Plato went to Egypt to study philosophy, where, according to legend, he was inducted into the elusive mystery schools, where the highest secrets of all creation are kept. In his book Phaedrus, he tells, through Socrates, the story of Thoth, god of reason, bestowing upon humanity that boon to critical thinking that is writing. Later in history, Greek mystics would venerate Thoth as Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the thrice great, hero and namesake of the esoteric school of Hermeticism, from which the alchemical tradition would spring. The Egyptian influence on ancient Greek philosophy and the development of Western thought in general is undeniable. So let's take a minute to look at ancient Greece before the time of Socrates, in order to provide some context for our next episode, which will deal in part with that holy trinity of Greek wisdom, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle.
Apollo! 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 Wake up, destroyer! Again, you're Cassandra's appalling destroyer!
God. As with China, Sumer, Babylon, and Egypt, Greek culture begins with myth. Of course, the Greek knowledge-bearer was Prometheus, whose story I briefly covered in my book. Prometheus brought primitive humanity fire, and from there, they learned to use their minds. They learned to think critically.
Racked by infinite tortures none can number, refusing to bow before Zeus, deliberately honoring man to excess. Oh, Prometheus!
Thank you. Let me speak of the miseries of men, helpless children, till I gave them sense and ways to think. Though I do not mention man through any blame, but only to unfold the love with which I gave. Like huddled shapes in dreams, they used to drag their long lives through confusing awe. Until I showed the stars to them, their rising and their set. And numbers too, I found them, the key to sciences. And letters in their synthesis, secret of all memory, sweet mother of the arts. I was the first to break beasts to the yoke, and I was the one, none other, to invent the seaman's ocean-roaming chariots with linen wings. The whole truth in a sentence, if you want it short, is every art to man Prometheus brought. I also gave them fire.
Fire with its eye of flame. Do the day beings have that now?
Yes, and shall learn a thousand arts from it.
For his crime of delivering forbidden wisdom and knowledge to the human race, Prometheus was brutally punished. However, as he could foresee all things, he knew that one day, even mighty Zeus would fall, and he would be freed. Much later in the chronology of Greek mythology, but still during the reign of Zeus, there arose another champion of reason, Odysseus, the hero of Homer's Odyssey. Odysseus was one of the great generals in the Trojan War, distinctly known for his conniving tactics. Athena, the goddess of wisdom and war, took a liking to his intellect and helped him along in his journey home from Troy. The Odyssey is full of his exploits, but one of my favorite is his escapades on the island of the Cyclops. Odysseus and his men were trapped in the cave of the giant Cyclops Polyphemus. To escape, Odysseus first introduced himself as No Man. Then he offered Polyphemus some wine, which of course got the big guy drunk. When Polyphemus blacked out, Odysseus, with the help of his men, drove a big, sharp log into the Cyclops' single eye. He screamed and screamed, but when his Cyclops buddies heard him screaming from outside the cave and asked who was attacking him, he said, "No man is attacking me. No man is attacking me." So they left, and so did Odysseus. Brilliant. But all this was still during the reign of Zeus. Prometheus had predicted that eventually, even the god of gods would be dethroned, and a new order would be established, driven by humans in their new rational minds. I suggest that this happened around 625 BC, when Thales, Greece's first philosopher, was born. At this point, and perhaps culminating in the thought of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, the old Greek gods were overthrown by the reason of men. Prometheus was exonerated, and reason, not pagan mysticism, continues to drive progress to this day. The Greek philosophers that came before Socrates are now all identified under the banner of pre-Socratic. This designation isn't to denigrate them so much as it is to exalt Socrates. With his method of inquiry and argumentation, he changed the game of philosophy forever. The pre-Socratics lived and worked in the 6th and 5th centuries BC, and despite their being lumped under this one very broad term, they certainly did not all agree. Thales, the first philosopher who I have already mentioned, for instance, believed that the fundamental thing underlying reality was water. Unfortunately, there are only 4 sentences actually written by Thales himself that survive today, but according to Aristotle, Thales tried to back up his claim with a logical argument. As with Confucius and Mencius, Thales' logic isn't going to live up to the standards we'll set in the next episode. But hey, at least he gave it a shot. His idea was that the world must be made up of some kind of basic stuff. Fundamental, indivisible stuff. He thought that this stuff would have to be capable of giving rise to all the other, more specific stuff that we engage with. Only water, it appeared, could fit the bill. Water could exist in all 3 states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas. Land was born of the water, as it appears to jut up from the sea. And if one digs deep enough, what do you find? Water. Water also turns into air, he thought, mistakenly figuring that this was the purpose of evaporation. Though he wound up being wrong, his great contribution to thought was that he assumed that things had natural causes, and that these causes must make sense. He didn't just say, "I don't get it, the gods must have done it." He sought to understand the world, well, scientifically. For this, he is remembered as the first actual philosopher. The most famous of the pre-Socratics is probably Pythagoras, but unfortunately, this is likely only because we're all forced to memorize his Pythagorean theorem in school. A squared plus b squared equals c squared, that thing. But don't let bad memories of math class poison your well, though. Pythagoras was actually a really weird and fascinating guy. At least, he might have been. All we really have to go on about him is rumor and legend. But that just makes him more interesting. What we can know about is the school of thought founded in the wake of Pythagoras, the Pythagoreans. They believed, as Pythagoras taught, that the underlying fundamental aspect of reality was not water, as Thales had suggested, but number. Unfortunately, no logical or argumentative proof for this position survives today. However, they did state that the universe is governed by mathematical relationships, that noise becomes music by way of numbers, and that, as we say today, mathematics is the language of the universe. The Pythagoreans weren't always so modern and scientific-sounding, though. They had all sorts of oddball rules, like never stoking a fire with an iron rod, not picking up objects that they've dropped, and absolutely not, under any circumstances, eating beans. They also believed that Pythagoras was the reincarnation of Patroclus, Achilles' squire and maybe probably lover from the Iliad. Nonetheless, the Pythagoreans somehow reconciled all this with their mathematical outlook on things. In the long run, their sacred geometry, again, geometry meaning land measurement, would long outlive their more dopey beliefs. Over the door of Plato's Academy was hung a sign, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter in here." Today, one could hardly deny the fundamental role mathematics plays in both the universe and our understanding of it. The last pre-Socratic philosopher I'd like to note is Xenophanes, a really interesting chap who wasn't afraid to call the whole of Greek religion into question. He disliked Homer and Hesiod, and thought that the gods were irrational, unpleasant, and, in fact, imaginary. But he wasn't just a cynical bastard. He backed up his claims with reasons. He argued, quite profoundly, that the Greeks had made up their gods. His evidence for this was the fact that, when depicted, the gods all looked like Greeks. They spoke Greek, revealed themselves to Greeks, and lived in Greece. And yet, if you travel to Ethiopia, you find that all of their gods look Ethiopian, speak Ethiopian, revealed themselves to Ethiopians, and, yes, live in Ethiopia. In short, Xenophanes argued that man creates the gods in his own image, and often the gods reflect the very worst of human nature. And, unlike the arguments made by Confucius, Mencius, and Thales, his arguments were totally legit. To drive his point home, he even said, quote, "Mortals suppose that the gods are born and have clothes and voices and shapes like their own. But if oxen, horses, and lions had hands or could paint with their hands and fashion works as men do, horses would paint horse-like images of gods, and oxen oxen-like ones, and each would fashion bodies like their own." Unquote. Checkmate, bitch. And if that wasn't cool enough for you, Xenophanes also challenged animism in general, continuing Thales' tradition of positing natural rather than mystical explanations for things, by saying, "No, the sun's not a god, it's a big ball of fire." I mean, yeah, he actually argued that. This guy really is too much. And it's not like he was an atheist or anything. He just found the convenient Greekness and bad manners of the pagan gods to be superstitious and irrational. Instead, he advocated for a single, all-powerful, totally good God with a capital G. The true God, he said, is completely beyond human understanding. but the closest we could ever hope to get to him, or her, or it, would be through our use of reason. And that, I think, is an excellent place to leave it for now. Next time, we'll be looking at those who Xenophanes would have been proud to call his successors, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, each of whom pursued truth, not by lazily relying on absurd tradition, but by actively engaging with their innate rational capacity. We'll also talk a bit about the ancient Romans, who followed in the philosophical footsteps of the Greeks, and see how critical thinking developed in the years leading up to the Middle Ages. Thank you for joining me on this episode 1 of the Story of Nowhere podcast. This has been A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 1, Shamans, Seers, and Sacred Geometry. Adios.
Oh, wise are the ones who bow before the Absolute.
Bow down, adore and cringe before each ruler of the day. For me, your Zeus is less than naught. So let him play at what he wants, and lord it for his little day. His time for ruling gods is short.